So today we come to the concluding section of Exodus chapter 2. I'm reading verses 15 through 25, reading this morning from the New American Standard Bible. When Pharaoh heard of this, that is, when Moses killed the Egyptian slave master, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the presence of Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Now notice this, verse 17, then the shepherds came and drove them away. Let me just stop right there and remind you of something that we learned back when we were studying. I don't remember if it was Mark's gospel or John's gospel or both, where Jesus occasionally referred to himself as the good shepherd. And how in that time and in that culture, that was rather oxymoronic. In other words, the idea of good and shepherd going together didn't make much sense to those people. Shepherds did not have a good reputation in that culture. They were bad guys. I don't mean in the sense of cutthroats and thieves, but they weren't well regarded. They were low on the food chain, if you will. So these shepherds are behaving like shepherds. They're driving off Moses' daughters. But now notice, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. Verse 18, when they came to Reuel, their father, he said, why have you come back so soon today? So he's accustomed to them having to be harassed by these shepherds and it taking a long time to get the water. So they said, an Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds. And what is more, he even drew the water for us and watered the flock. He, that is the priest of Midian, said to his daughters, where is he then? Why is it that you've left the man behind? Invite him to have something to eat. Typical Middle Eastern hospitality, we would say today. Verse 21, Moses was willing to dwell with the man. And he gave, that is the priest of Midian, gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses. That is to be his wife. Verse 22, then she gave birth to a son and he named him Gershom. For he said, I have been a sojourner or a stranger in a foreign or strange land. Now it came about in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died. And the sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God saw the sons of Israel, and God took notice of them. And there ends the reading of God's holy, infallible, and inerrant word. Let me begin by telling you that I once heard a story about a woman who had experienced a great deal of personal tragedy in her life. Her heartache and her sorrow were so great that she was overheard on one occasion to remark, I wished I had never been made. And a friend of hers standing nearby reminded her, my dear, you not only are not fully made yet, you are only being made, and this is the maker's process. Now, no doubt Moses must have wished on occasion that he had never been made. I mean, we saw last week that he killed an Egyptian for beating one of his Hebrew kinsmen. And we saw that the result was that he had to flee Egypt and go to this place. It is my contention, at least, that the murder of that Egyptian was against God's will. I think that much is evident, that it was a crime, it was a murder, because of Pharaoh's intended reaction. But the Lord is going to use Moses' exile in Midian in the process of making him into the great man of God that he will become. And as Moses arrives on the scene in Midian, we see him intervening on behalf of the defenseless and the weak. The same thing he was doing back in Egypt. The priest of Midian's daughters were constantly harassed by these shepherds, as I said, as they tried to draw water from the well for the family. They're generally forced to wait for long hours, apparently, while the shepherds water their sheep and before the daughters of the priest of Midian could water for their family. Moses, from what we can tell, does not kill anybody here, but he delivers the women from the hands of their oppressors, and he even draws the water for them. So even here, we see that he is growing and maturing in his walk with the Lord. That was Moses' entrance. That was his introduction to the land of Midian. And it is there, that place, that God is going to reveal the call that he has on Moses' life. The Midianites, well, they are the distant cousins of the people of Israel. Midian, the father of this nation, was the son of Abraham and his third wife, Keturah. Now that's important for us to know because Moses is going to learn a lot about the true God from his father-in-law, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Moses, though an Israelite, has been raised on the Egyptian religion. He's been raised in the best schools of the laws of Egypt. So this time of sojourn or exile with the priest of Midian is going to be used by the Lord to ground Moses in the truth. Moses' exile in Midian will prepare him spiritually for the great task that God has in store for him. But also, it's worth noting that physically, the geography of this land will also prepare him for the great physical task ahead of him of leading these people out of Egypt toward Canaan. And we ought to make note of something else about his time in Midian, and that is the similarities, the symbolism or the relationship between the life of Moses and his ancestor Jacob at this point. Because, you know, last week I referred you to the lying deception of Jacob and his mother Rebekah. And I mentioned that as an example of the sin of not trusting the Lord. To work things out, his promises in his own time. Jacob and his mother conspired to steal Esau's birthright. They didn't wait on the Lord, and as a result, Jacob had to, maybe you don't remember, but listen, he had to flee into exile. He had to flee to the house of a relative in another country, just as Moses does here. It was during Jacob's exile that he met his future wife, Rachel. And guess where he met her? At a well. And he helped her as she came to water the sheep, just as Moses is doing here. Both Jacob and Moses were taken to the home of the father of the woman that they helped. And both of them eventually married the girl as well. So the Midianite priest gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses as his wife, and they soon have a son, and he names him Gershom. Now, I think there is in that name a hint of some of the emotional challenges that Moses is dealing with here. Notice it says in verse 21, Moses was content, that is, he was willing to live with the man, the priest of Midian. But he gives his son a name that means a stranger, a sojourner in a foreign land, a stranger in a strange land. If you're a Robert Heinlein fan, then you'll know where the name of his famous science fiction novel came from. So I think this is a reflection of how Moses felt about his exile. He's willing to live in Midian, but the name he gives his son reveals, I think, a restlessness and a burning in his soul to return to Egypt to help his people. But that time of exile is important, because Moses will learn from the priest of Midian, and I mentioned this a moment ago, about Yahweh, the true God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God who's calling him back to Egypt to fulfill his destiny. At this point, let me tell you something. When I was living in Philadelphia during my seminary days, I heard a story about a man who took the commuter train from the suburbs down to Center City, Philadelphia, just about every day. Now, that train took him right through some of the most impoverished and crime-ridden areas of Philadelphia. Every day, this well-to-do businessman, who had a nice, lovely home in the tranquil suburbs, he had to ride past decaying tenements, dilapidated public housing projects, and dirty, trash-covered streets. And when the train slowed down, the man could see all too well the clear, the sullen faces and desperate faces of the people who lived in that bombed out part of the city. He could see unemployed men standing around a fire in a vacant lot waiting for someone to pick them up for day labor. And he would see young children playing on dusty basketball courts. And the man wondered if there's anybody who cared about those kids. And sometimes while he was at work, he would catch himself daydreaming and staring off into space, thinking about those nameless people who inhabited that desperate, depressing world. And he began having trouble sleeping at night because every time he closed his eyes, he would see the faces of those people and the squalor they lived in. And he made up his mind that he was going to do something about it. And let me tell you, he did. Because now when he rides the train to work, he pulls the shade down so he doesn't have to see that depressing environment all around him. He's now at peace. He doesn't have to see it anymore. He shuts it out of his mind and life. Now, I tell you that story because I'm telling you that Moses was not like that businessman. He would not pull the shade down on the circumstances of his people. And the reason he would not was because God would not forget his covenant and his people in their misery and sorrow. In the last few verses of this chapter, we come upon what is really a description of the character of God. And in those words, we're told that God loves, he cares, he intervenes in the lives of his people. And we learn in verses 24 to 25, he hears them, he hears their groaning, he remembers the covenant, he sees, he looks upon them, and he knows, he acknowledges them. In the earlier part of this chapter, we made what was a 40-year, well, maybe 30, 20, 30, we don't really know how many years it was, but we're guessing somewhere between maybe 20 and 30 years, between verses 10 and 11. I pointed that out to you last week, because in one verse, verse 10, Moses is still a young man. But in the next verse, verse 11, we're told he's a mature man. And as we heard from our New Testament reading today from Acts 7, Moses was at that point 40 years old. So there is not only a jump in age, but a 20, 30-year period of silence about Moses during this time of his life. I mean, if he's a young man in verse 10 and he's 40 years old in verse 11, that's 20 or 30 years where nothing is said about what he was doing. And now that he's gone into Midian, we've come across another period of silence regarding Moses. Because between verses 22 and 23, there's this other phase of his life that is passed over. It's not described. So let's remember, the point of this is that God may be silent in your life for a time, but that doesn't mean he's unconcerned. Think about the two most agonizing experiences Jesus had to endure in his earthly life. His agony in the Garden of Gethsemane and, of course, his crucifixion. And in both those instances, the Lord was greeted by the silence of God, his Father. Yet surely, I think this is a safe conjecture, God the Father could not have been any closer to his Son than on those two occasions. When Michelle and I were members of Trinity Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Hatboro, Pennsylvania during our seminary days, we were in a Sunday school class that dealt with suffering and grief. It was actually an R.C. Sproul video series on those topics. There were about 10 people in this particular group. And among them was an older woman who had an interest in that class because of something that happened to her some years earlier. She was a longtime member of this congregation, of this OPC church. Her husband had been murdered almost 10 years earlier while he was out making a sales call. And she told our class that in the midst of all of that chaos and utter devastation, of all the expressions of sympathy for which she was very grateful, in that terrible tragedy, the one that meant the most to her came from the man who was, at the time of the tragedy, the pastor of that church. She said when he learned about the killing of her husband, he went straight to her house, he rang the doorbell, she opened the door, he walked in, he didn't say a word. He was silent. All he did was reach out and put his arms around her and gave her a big hug, and then, still silent, he turned and he left. Even in silence, my friends, God is still at work on behalf of his people. Moses was soon to find that out in a most incredible way. Now, I want to go back to those four words that I mentioned a moment ago. These words that describe God, they show us the deeply personal way in which God is involved in the lives of those with whom he's made this covenant. Let me mention them again and briefly say something about them. God heard their groaning. Their cry came up to him. That's the first one. The misery of those people, their pain and their anguish was heard by the Lord. Now, I don't think that that means they had a weekly whining session, you know, where they'd wail and moan. Maybe they did, but I don't think that's what it means. Rather, I think it meant that God heard the unspoken prayers of their hearts. You know, there are some people, maybe some of you here today are listening by means of our audio sermon, who know well that there are times of pain and grief in life when you simply cannot speak. The feeling simply cannot be expressed in words, as that OPC pastor expressed silently in visiting that new widow. What we learn here is that God hears the voice of our groaning, even though the groaning that stirs within doesn't have a sound to it. But then secondly, we're told God remembered. He remembered his covenant. This is one of the constant themes of the Older Testament. God is faithful in keeping his covenant promises. Throughout Scripture, we see that time and again. Even though the people fail, even though his people rebel, God is always faithful because this is who God is. This is part of what it means for him to be God. And that means the big issue here is not whether the people pleased or displeased the Lord. I mean, that's an issue. But the big issue is that God was faithful despite their unfaithfulness. And then thirdly, God looked upon the children of Israel. In Psalm 34, verse 15, reading from the ESV, we read that the eyes of Yahweh are toward the righteous and his ears toward their cry. Yahweh looking upon those people means, when it says he looked upon them, it means much more than simply seeing something with the naked eye. And the word translated here, looked upon or saw, it has a deeper meaning than just seeing something, like I'm seeing this Bible here or this hymn book. It means to look upon with sympathy. It means to look with an understanding of what that's like that I'm seeing. Not only to see, but to, on some level, experience what is being seen. God had sympathy for the people in a special way. But let's hasten to remember that sympathy was not based on their being more righteous or holy than anybody else. God's sympathy for those people was based solely on the fact that he had made a covenant with their fathers. So God loved them because he had loved their fathers first. And then finally, God acknowledged them. That means that God had an intimate knowledge of these people. Another way of saying that is that God was concerned in a deep way about the people. He knew what they were dealing with. And he knew it was time for action. And I think that's a good way to think about it. On the other hand, think about it this way too. Think about, you know, how you react when someone tells you some sad news about somebody they knew or they know. And maybe you don't know anything about that person. Maybe you know the name, maybe you've met them a few times, but you don't really know them all that well. Now, of course, you're sympathetic, and you're not glad to hear any sad news about anybody, especially some friend of a friend of yours. But if you don't really know them, it's hard to be really deeply concerned about them, at least in the same way you would if some terrible thing befell someone to whom you are very, very close. Well, that's what the Bible is telling us here. God is concerned about those Israelite people because he knows them. Let me ask you a question. The story I told about the man, the businessman riding the commuter train into Center City, Philadelphia, and pulling the shade down as he rode through the slums. Remember how we learned when Moses had grown up, it was then that he saw the oppression of his people and he wanted to do something about it. And remember last week when we learned about the Pharaoh's daughter finding baby Moses in the river and seeing him, she had compassion on him. Well, you see, all of that is to remind us of that as a member of God's covenant family, we are to, now listen carefully, we are to be or to act like better. We are to act like God. You know, last Sunday we heard something from Joshua about the Eastern Orthodox doctrine of theosis. I'm not going to get into detail about that, but let me just say for those of you who are here, or those listening by means of audio, this is not what we're talking about. Acting like God is not the same thing as theosis. How in the world are you, a human being, going to act like God? I mean, we usually use that in a negative way, don't we? But not here. The only way that we as human beings can remotely do that is by acting like God acts and doing what he does. I don't mean that in a cosmic way. I don't mean that in an omnipresent metaphysical way. But ask yourself, what does God do? He sees, he hears, he remembers, and he is concerned. Keeping with the Eastern Orthodox theme here for a moment, I'm not sure why I'm keeping with that theme, but I came across a story from the Russian Orthodox tradition in old Russia about a small village where the priest of an Orthodox church in that village was preparing for the highest holy day in the Orthodox Christian calendar, that is, the eve of Easter Sunday. So the people had all gathered at this little Orthodox church on the edge of the village for that special Sunday evening or eve before Sunday service. But when it came time to start this service, the Orthodox priest was nowhere to be found. Well, while the people are sort of waiting and milling around, waiting for him, a young mother who had gone to the service left her daughter at home. She slipped out of the service before it began to go home and check on her. That was in a time in that place, in any place, where everybody in the village was a Christian. And you could do something like that. You could leave your little child sleeping at home all alone. So she went back to her house, and to her great surprise, when she walked into the house, there was the priest, there was the pastor sitting quietly in a chair, holding the little child in his arms. It seems he'd been walking by the house on his way to the church, and he overheard the child crying, and he stopped in to help. And he held her, and he rocked her until she'd gone to sleep. My friends, too often we get so caught up in the rush and struggle of modern life that we fail to act as God acts. We fail to show others the love and concern that God has shown us. Now, you may not ever be called by God to be another Moses or Abraham. And yes, the fact is, for most of us, the really big history-changing, earth-moving opportunities for service to God come very, very seldom. But if we would look around and see and hear and remember, we will find that we are surrounded by small but no less important opportunities to, by God's grace, serve him every day of our lives. And by his grace, let us go forth and do that. Let us pray.